All right, this is Psychology 107, Buddhist Psychology, and I'm delighted that you all are interested in this. Find seats. The fire department does not like people sitting in the aisle. My aim in the lecture today is to give you an overview of the class so that you have perspective on what you're going to be learning all semester, and also to give enough information that you'll be able to decide whether you actually want the class. But first, I'd like to know something about your background. So, how many of you have ever done anything that was named meditation? Wow. Okay, how about yoga? This is amazing. Martial arts. Relaxation or stress reduction exercises. My goodness. Family members, you know, grandmother who was a Buddhist or Hindu or Taoist. Okay. And how many of you are fresh newbies and haven't done any of it? All right, this is going to be an interesting mixture of a class. You will have great sections, and you have four wonderful GSIs who can stand up. You're right here. Olga and Erica and Stephanie or Steph and Craig. So one other housekeeping item, which is, how many of you are on the wait list? Okay, how many of you are new and you just wandered in and you're not on the wait list yet? Oh, all right, this is great. The wait list people and any new people, I would like you to fill out this form before you leave. There aren't that many of you, so I'll end a little bit early. You can get them and fill them out and turn them in. That will tell me that you're here and give me some information about you. My hope is that enough people that will be able to get everyone who decides that they want the class in without having to exclude anyone who wants the class, because some of you will decide, it's not my cup of tea. All right, so this is a somewhat unusual class, and why have it? Well, there are these really different two modes of doing research into the mind. It's a psychology class, and the brain fellow represents our current psychology, and the Buddha head represents the Buddhist tradition. And what I'm going to be doing is primarily giving the class from the point of view of the Buddhist tradition itself. There will be two lectures on Western research, and I'll bring in some of the Western stuff. The reason for not doing it the other way around is that if you were going to take it from what we know currently, or our current theories in psychology, and what we know which isn't really that much about the brain, and then say, well, there are a few interesting things that seem to happen with meditation, and we'll figure out what's really going on, and, you know, dispense with all this, you know, the M-word mystical stuff, that what you're assuming is that our present psychology already knows everything important. They have it all laid out. They just have to mop up a few details. And from the length of time that I've been looking into this, I feel that the Buddhist tradition really has something to offer psychology. And in order to pick up what that is, you have to do it the other way around, from the Buddhist point of view. Now, what do I mean by the two modes? Well, what our psychology does is look at the mind from the outside, do research on it as though it's a thing. And what the Buddhist perspective and other meditation-based perspectives do is look at it from the inside, from the point of view of someone who has a mind. Now, there was a time when I was on a symposium with Marion Diamond, the very charismatic, great biology teacher here. So we're all sitting at one of those long tables with, you know, our little pitchers of water, and Marion Diamond gets up to give her talk, and she gets up carrying a bucket, a pail, and walks in front of me, and the pail is going slosh, slosh, slosh. How many of you have taken a course from Marion Diamond? Oh, one lucky person. It smells a little funny. So she's standing there and she's talking, and then she reaches into the pail and holds out a human brain, dripping. And the whole, which looks very different from a plaster model. And the whole audience goes, and it gets deadly quiet, you know, not as a pin drop. Oh, I wish I could do that here. But you see, what this class is about is you all have a dripping mind in there, and that's what it's about. Okay, so how do we study it? Well, the method is meditation, but not the kind of meditation you might think of when we say the word, not going off into some kind of other space, but being mindful, which is why the Buddhism part, because it specializes in mindfulness, which is just being present with your body and your mind and your emotions and, you know, your thoughts as they occur. So we'll have practices that get you to do that a bit, and in daily life. So the whole of your daily life is grist for the mill for this course, being able to look at that. And the meditation techniques change as we go through the course and have different topics. So that next week, next Wednesday, you'll have your first meditation instruction in mindfulness from the point of view of the earliest Buddhism. And then thereafter, the 5 minutes before the class starts, you'll be doing whatever meditation we're doing during that period, and 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning of section. And you're encouraged to do it at home, and also to pay attention to what your mind is doing outside of that. Okay, here's the outline for today's lecture. the promises and the perils and what's in the class. The promises are just, you know, why I think these contents of the class are important. And you have a list of them, which you can look at, and which I'm going to go over each one in turn. And then, how are we going to cover that list? Well, the syllabus, and how it's going to do it. And finally, you've got your list of perils. And if you're looking at this, you can see that many of them are the same as the promises. It's just the difficulties that doing your psychology in a different way can create. Okay, the first of the promises is, yes. And Chris, you don't know whether it's the lion looking at the kitty or the kitty looking at the lion. We're rather alienated from our own experience. There's really a difference between direct experience, as it's called, you know, being with what's going on with you, and looking at your own experience through the lens of the kind of cocoon of all our concepts and our judgments, and all of our habits that we have. And the more alienated, the more distant one is from your own experience, it's like going to a restaurant and picking up the menu and saying, "Oh, you know, boy, I'm really hungry," and then trying to eat the menu instead of the food. It's not very satisfactory, and you wonder, why isn't it satisfactory? You know, I read all the reviews on Yelp. It's supposed to be a good restaurant. So that's one reason, namely it's more satisfying to you with your gripping mind. Another reason is that our psychology is also kind of alienated from real minds. You may have noticed that what you're studying is theories and the experiments that have been done about the theories, and then you're going to learn to do research, and nobody asks you whether the theory makes sense for you or for what you observe of other people. It's whether you can figure out something to do bouncing off the theory with another theory. So both in clinical and in research, it would be good to, you know, pay more attention to what minds actually do. And for clinicians, so many have told me that they go through the whole theoretical training, and then they're faced with a live person that's troubled, and there's the shock of, what do I do? So, for the sake of psychology. And finally, what Buddhism says and other meditation traditions say, and what lots of people say, what you get in contact with is that there is a more basic level of the mind than our concepts, or than the kind of emotions where you're struggling just to survive and you're grabbing at things and you're pushing things away and you're ignoring things that you want to ignore. And this underlying level of the mind really functions in a different way that might actually have bearing not only on oneself, but on world conditions. The world is in bad shape. And it's, if you look at things, most people are just really good. They want to do the right thing. They want to take care of their families. They love their children. They want to earn a decent living. They want to do the right thing in general by their religions, by their maybe humanism or but they don't want to destroy their nest, their habitat, and yet look what's happening. It's not working. It's not enough. So maybe what is needed is another finding a different sort of mind. And here's my favorite quote from Einstein. Well, one of my favorite quotes altogether, which is that problems can never be solved with the same minds that created them. So all of this may have societal value, and there's actually an enlightened society vision that's part of Buddhism, especially today. I've already talked about that this mindfulness kind of meditation and the idea of mindfulness, psychologists are already getting interested in it and using it very effectively for clinical health and psychological benefits, and trying to do research on what's going on. But what they lack is the whole context of where mindfulness came from in the first place. So the course is going to try to give that. And finally, I know a lot of you would like to learn something about Buddhism, which is that whole context. And what I'll say at this point is that both scholars, Buddhist studies scholars, and people within the tradition agree that there are three major forms of Buddhism in the world. It's a tradition that's 2,500 years old. It's been around for a while, and it developed, and it has these phases in its evolution. Interestingly, unlike, you know, you could look at the Western religions that way too, but they split into three different and sometimes warring factions, and Buddhism retained the idea that they were all the same tradition. And in fact, from the point of view of the later ones, that each change historically builds on and incorporates the earlier part. So those three are, to back up slightly, so Buddhism started in India and then it spread. The earliest form spread into Southeast Asia, you know, Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, and is still there. There were 18 schools. The one remaining one, the living one, is called Theravada, which means speech of the elders. The Buddhism evolved, and the next wave of spread was into East Asia, so Vietnam, China, Korea, Japan, and that's the Mahayana, which means great vehicle. Yana is vehicle. And then finally, again, still evolving in India, the Vajrayana, or the diamond vehicle, early form spread along the east route, and there are still some forms of it in Japan. And the latest form went north into Tibet. There's perhaps a fourth type or a fourth jhana, and it's evolving right here. It's fascinating to watch this happen, called Shambhala. And they actually say, well, we don't need to be Buddhism. We need to incorporate the wisdom of Buddhism. We start from the highest wisdom, and we incorporate the other things from the world that need to be brought in. And they're the ones that are saying that just individual development isn't enough. You also need enlightened society, and the two have to happen at the same time. Now, from the Tibetan, which is the latest to evolve, other than Shambhala, there's a way of teaching that they sometimes use called the three jhana approach. And its idea is that the development of an individual mind mirrors the historical development of Buddhism. Okay, so what you see first when you start to meditate is the things that the earliest school saw and is part of their teachings. And then the next school builds on that, and then the next. And this is a wonderful device for having a class. It has worked in the past. So this is the way that I'm going to teach this. One time teaching this, there was a girl who found this very obnoxious. Oh, it may have been other times, but she was vocal about it. And so just, you know, warning, this, it's going to be a mixture of the history, and it's going to be like the development of the human fetus goes through the evolutionary stages, and that's called technically ontogeny, recapitulating phylogeny. So that's what we'll be doing. Now, how are we going to cover all this? Okay, now the syllabus. Week one, we are in week one. You are here. This is introduction. And in order to help introduce you, I've got a whole bunch of little short readings from in different voices so that you can see whether which ones, well, you can see the variety and get a sense of which ones are going to speak to me. So don't worry about the number of them. Not all of them will speak to you. It's to give you a chance to connect in some way. Maybe none of them will. Maybe the whole thing won't. If that's the case, then early on you know that you're one of the people that's not your cup of tea, and you can not get trapped in here. Occasionally, well, there often are one or two people in a class this size or even smaller who end up getting trapped, and they're miserable. And if they're industrious, they will come to class and probably sit in the front row and look like they're being tortured. So I don't get off on being the torturer, so do check out whether this is your thing. Okay. Week two, next week, that's when we get the meditation, and I've already talked about that. The one thing I want to add is, so the ground rules for meditating in class is that you not bother your neighbors, which means that, you know, your mind is your own, you can do, and if you want to sit and worry and not do whatever the technique is, be my guest. But if you take out a book and read and turn pages or mess with your computer or talk to your neighbor or make out in the back, none of you look like you're about to do that, but who knows? It's a class where people get friendly. then you will bother someone, and they will, after a while, complain, and or I'll see you or something. And I don't know what we'll do in that case, because. But we'll find some sanctions to apply. And ever since I've started announcing for people not to do it, there hasn't been any trouble, so I don't know what we would do were you to do it. If you have to come in late, the other, I've never been in this room before. It may be possible because there's sufficient space for you to come in without bothering people, but we'll see. And it's only going to be 5 minutes, so you can probably suffer through 5 minutes of being quiet. All right. This is about in life. Now, to understand this, looks like you don't know the context, which is a while ago, there was this massive ad, public interest ad campaign, saying, do you know where your teenager is? And on the TV, and you remember that, and in magazines and everything, between programs, it's 9 o'clock, do you know where your teen is? It's 10 o'clock, it's midnight, do you know where? Yeah, right. So this is, you can remind yourself, oh, it's 10 o'clock, do I know where my mind is? Okay, weeks 3 to 5, the Theravada, the earliest tradition that we're going to build on. And this is where you're going to, through mindfulness, analyze the mind into its parts, its components, and how the components link up, how it works, and see your own pain and problems and want out of that, which is why we're not mindful in the first place, and see how to change habits. There's a wonderful analysis of a habit from the inside and why they're so hard to break. And at least if you were doing this for real, and maybe a little bit in the class, strip away some of the cocoon. And the traditional fruition of this part of Buddhism is nirvana, after you die, which is that you're, well, they don't say what it is, so I won't say. Week 6, that will be the class on the Western research on mindfulness, and then the midterm is October 6th. Week 7 to 9 is the basic Mahayana, which adds to what the first part did, your dimension of emptiness, as it's called, which I like to call openness and compassion. And the idea is when you start taking away the cocoon, phony stuff, you are not your Facebook profile. Then from spontaneously, this warmth, friendliness, love, compassion arises. Then we get late Mahayana, which is actually where our ideas of Buddhism come from. So Zen and some other traditions that have come over here and is our image of Buddhism tends to be late Mahayana. With apologies to any of you who are Zen practitioners, because you've been told that Zen isn't any of these things, it's just plain Zen. And that's true in the same way that you're all just plain you, but you also fit into categories. And I'll talk about Western research on compassion, which there is not much of. And we will have a transition to Vajrayana. Week 11 is the Vajrayana and the Shambhala that's evolved off of it. Finding an actual ground, getting grounded to live from, that's positive. And in fact, the Shambhala term is basic goodness. So when finding that, then you can deal with all the energies of the world and do things. Okay, last 3 weeks of the class are implications. What good is all this for living? And we will run through all those topics that you can see in your syllabus, you know, religion, daily life, romantic love, work, art, nightlife, sleep, dreams, dying, life's problems, emotions, stress, and so on. And finally, the social issue. And finally, a summary. And then the RRR week will be used for some review sessions. Two of the GSIs with their sections will have the class time on Monday and two on Wednesday, and they'll tell you which day you have. And of course, it's optional. Well, you know, the whole thing is optional. That's, okay, the perils. Yeah. There's a legend in Buddhism that before of the pearl fishers, so going out in these little boats to do pearl fishing was very hazardous, and so the captain of the little boat would gather his crew and he'd warn them for 3 days, and at the end of each day, those that were left, he would cut one of the anchors, the cords to the anchor, and by the third day, then they would set sail. So actually, I have four perils, but so concepts function differently in academia and Buddhism, and you are all, whatever you think, you are all successes, big successes. You've gotten in here, and here you are. And so you have been, you've gotten very good at doing the academic kind. And you expect classes to be that way. The Naropa was an Indian siddha, one with who developed powers, but he started out as an academic at Nalanda University, this big mega university in northern India. And the story goes, the legend goes, one day he's sitting on his balcony studying his books on logic, epistemology, Buddhist precepts, and grammar, when an apparition appears to him, a shadow over his shoulder. It's an old hag, and she asks what he's doing. He tells her, and she asks him if he understands it, and he says, yes. And she says, do you understand the words or the meaning? And he says, I understand the words, and she's very happy. And he says, oh, I also understand the meaning. And she goes into a rage and flings her stick down. And he asks, how come, you know, why? And she says, well, you, a great, you know, were truthful. You realized that you only understood the words, but then you told a lie when you said you also understood the meaning. And then he leaves and goes on a quest, and one of these mythic quests, and ends up in the form that you see him there, having attained, having found the meaning, not just the words. So, yeah. Now, so the usual way to understand the concepts that you're taught is in relation to other concepts. And here's what you might start out with. So it's concepts relating to other concepts, other kind of committing incest with each other and giving birth to still more concepts with some observations. And the ideas that you're going to end up like this, with all of them organized. Whereas the Buddhist is like this. Yeah, it's simple. And that's the problem people have, because you've been taught to be so complicated. Now, that kind of very simple direct experience, it's different from information, from facts, from implications, from emotions, from philosophy, from cognitive science, and most of all from cognitive science philosophy. There was a meditator, she'd actually been in a number of traditions, who I was interviewing, and she was from Austin, Texas, and she was going to drive there for a family wedding just at the time when the cognitive science meetings on consciousness were happening in Arizona. And she asked, you know, would it be a good idea for me to stop in and see what they're doing? And I said, yeah, you know, yeah, I'd be interested in what you think. So she came back, and I said, oh, did you go to the meetings? What did you think? And she said, yeah, I went. And now she's from Austin, remember? Those folks wouldn't know peace of consciousness if it bit them in the ass. So it, you know, it because you're alienated from your own mind, when you get into doing this simple kind of stuff, you can feel claustrophobic, you know, bound up and kidnapped, and how am I going to understand? So there's a secret, which is all the tools that you're going to be given in the class, but you have to use them. Okay, peril two, it's kind of the same thing, but slightly different. The teachings are pointing to this deeper layer of the mind, like through your concept. And we all have that. That's probably why you're in the room anyway. You know, we have intuitions and intimations, and things get evoked, and the things that you can't get hold of but that feel important. Well, if that's what it's about, how do I know what to study for the tests? Oh, tests. Okay, there's a secret to that. You're going to have a guide every week after the second lecture, when I know what I have said. There will be weekly study questions. And all the exam questions are going to be based on them. They won't be the same wording, but they will be the same ideas. Peril three, your presuppositions. Now, all the times that I've taught the class, there are people who would not raise their hands if I asked, but who are members of one of the Western religions, and they're a little bit uneasy at first. Isn't Buddhism a religion, and, you know, is this going to be a problem for me? It isn't. That's not, those aren't the folks to worry. It would be for some people, but they wouldn't, you know, the ones who, Buddhism, it's the work of the devil. If you believe that, you're not here. But just the rest of it, what they, there are usually three or four papers per time of people saying how the insights into the workings of the mind in this class have actually been helpful to them in their own religion. However, there's another religion that could be a problem. And we don't usually think of it as a religion, but it is scientism. This is not science per se. It's the assumption that that the way we're doing it now is the truth, and that is the way we're doing the science now, and it's not going to change, and that's it, and it's written in stone. Psychology is suffering from a kind of religion of brainism to some extent. Those of you, the psych people, know what I'm talking about. So the thing here is, you don't want to give that up. I mean, that's your training, it's what you're inspired by. But don't if you come in saying, all right, now how does whatever I'm studying explain whatever it is we're doing, it will be an obstacle. So you can just hold on to that, but put it in the pocket, or if you like the phenomenological term, you can bracket it, and then it won't be a problem. And of course, here we are walking bundles of daily life presuppositions, but that's what the class is about and what you get to look at. Okay. Now, the secret, if you're all clutched up about some of these presuppositions, it's because you already know you're on shaky ground. And you may be a fundamentalist about, for instance, your own self-image, that you can't do anything right, or about, you know, any one of a number of things. And you get so adamant because you know it's shaky. So all you have to do is be willing to look at the presuppositions. That last peril. Okay. It needs time for this stuff to soak in. So it's really, really hard to cram. And I say that because generations of students have discovered that and told me that. So the course requirements are the antidote to that. What I've tried to do, and what we're going to try to do, the requirements are there not so that we can evaluate you. I mean, they have that function, unfortunately, also, but as a way of nudging you along into understanding some of this stuff. So here they are. I hate exams. You probably hate exams. I don't know anyone who loves them. There's even research that being evaluated ruins you in a certain sense. Little kids study at Stanford, come into the experimental room, and they're given colorful magic markers and paper. And they, you know, you've seen little kids, they're drawing away. But half of them have been told that if they do a good job, they're going to get a treat at the end, they'll get a reward. And half of them have not been told anything. So they all scribble away, and of course, all the ones who told if they do a good job, they'll get a treat, get the treat. And 2 weeks later, they all come back, but the ones who were told they were getting a treat are told now they're not going to get a treat, but here are the paper with the magic markers. And the kids who did not have an evaluation to begin with sit down and they have a great old time with the magic markers, and the ones who were getting the treat the first time sit there and, oh, there's nothing to do, I'm bored, when can I go? So here you all are. Here I am. That's how it happens. The best that I can come up with is having these study questions so that you at least know what you need to study and don't have to try and figure it out. To keep you up to date so that you don't put it all aside, there is a weekly written one paragraph answer, your choice, to one of the study questions to be handed in. Your GSI will tell you when the different, to be handed in before or at the discussion of that topic. And those discussions will be at different times because your sections are on different days and have different schedules. That is purely to keep you up. If they won't be graded, and not all of them will be read. So it's kind of like getting a traffic ticket. If you turn in something that's just nonsense, there's a probability that it will be caught. That's to keep the GSI sane and cheery, because if they had to, yeah, you can picture what it would be like otherwise. I think I have gone over everything except the grading issue. Okay, we are not, if I said right now any questions about these requirements, somebody would ask, of all the things assigned, how many points does each get? Just think what you're doing. Again, that's a way of ruining the class for you, and we're not going to grade that way. Each person will be looked at as an individual. What do you understand? What were your strengths? And that way. And just think, this is the next to the last parting word. If you lived your life with that, from that strategic point of view, you would be miserable. I mean, just think of let's say you get married, and now you're thinking, how many minutes do I have to talk to my wife about how her day went so that she'll have sex with me? It's couples do things like that. They end up in therapy or divorce. So just, you know, relax and kind of enjoy the class. All right. The last thing is there will be weekly suggestions of a contemplative assignment for you to do for yourself. And this initial one is, as you're running around madly trying to get all your classes together or whatever you're doing, catch yourself and say, oh, what is my mind saying right now? And then ask, is that really so? You know, is that true? And see what happens. Okay, wait list and new people, fill one of these out, and others of you who have questions, I'll try and answer them.